My name is Lloyd Heberle. I'm a product engineer on the JavaScript API team. I work on the JavaScript portion of the ArcGIS for Developers website, and then I also help the team with, you know, guide topics and samples, and do sessions with Andy, like PhoneGap and mobile web apps. I'm also the product manager for the JavaScript Web Optimizer, and I think that's about it. Andy, who are you?
I'm on the developer outreach team. My focus is web, mobile, and native Android. And like Lloyd said, I work on Cordova, PhoneGap, Ionic, jQuery, Bootstrap, those types of things. And lately I've been focused on performance, so we get to talk about that as well.
So our agenda for today will set some expectations. We'll talk about some considerations and things that you can find in the API reference whenever it comes to designing for mobile, and then show you how to debug a mobile device. And then Andy's going to tell us some stuff about frameworks and some resources and projects that he's worked on over the last handful of years that can help you out. And so he's going to tell us about some of the new features in the 4X release with pop-ups, and then take us home with some geolocation stuff and some other good things like that, and then we'll wrap up. So just to set some expectations here, generally speaking, the reason why you would want to be here is that you are interested in reusing and leveraging your web development skills. You probably are interested in targeting multiple screen sizes or viewports, like a desktop application, have it also look and work well on a tablet and also on a mobile device. So if you're sitting there thinking in your head, what skills should I have? You should, you know, be familiar with HTML, JavaScript, cascading style sheets, and then if you're doing mobile, you know, be familiar with your device or have some sort of form or fashion to get your hands on a tablet or a phone, because that is something that you definitely need. And then you also need to understand who your audience is and what kind of devices they'll have, and targeting them appropriately. So we are kind of at an interesting point in history right now, that we have had the 3X version of the API since 2008. And so all of those years, we've been developing functionality and releasing that into the API. We've been working on the 4X API for, you know, probably a little over 2.5 years. We've had a couple beta releases. We just had the first initial 4.0 release. So you can probably realize that from 2008 to 2016, that's a lot of engineering time. And the 2.5 years that we've been working on 4, that's significantly less. So there's not feature parity between the 3X SDK and what you see in 4. So we have completely changed some of the patterns in which how you program. We've done a lot of things to make things responsive first out of the gate and made it easier to work with other frameworks. So if you want to use Angular, like Andy was talking about, or if you want to use some other framework, or you want the UI to look different, you don't have to specifically stick to what we give. Now, that being said, you know, everything that's in 3X is not in 4. So we're going to be continually evolving the 4X version. Over time, more of those features in 3X will show up in 4, and there'll be less development in 3. Over time. So today, if you're starting development, you know, the 3X has been around a lot longer, and depending on what functionality you need, you may need to use the 3X API. Now, some of the features that Andy's going to show with, like, related with the pop-ups with 4, that stuff is not possible or would take a significant amount of work in 3X to do or to write on your own. So we do have a feature functionality matrix, and so this is the 4X SDK, and under the guide tab, there's this choose a version, and it talks about the differences between the current 3X release and what's going on with 4 right now. And it'll... Oh, okay. Sorry. It's because I'm still in presenter mode. Thank you. So this is the 4X Resource Center, and it's under the Guide tab, choose a version, and it talks about the differences or the functionality, and then at the very bottom, there's this detailed functionality matrix, which goes into a lot greater detail of, you know, what the 3X module name was, what 4X is, some notes about that, if it's planned for the next release, and so on. So it's just important for you to understand this in doing your development with regards to feature functionality and just some of the mobile-specific things that you may run into. One other thing just to note is that 4X is supported. You can call tech support for that. If you're developing a mobile application and you run into something, you can call tech support and file a bug. You can also use this feedback on this topic in this lower right-hand corner, and all of the product engineering team gets that email sent to them. So that's one way you can quickly get a hold of us, and then you can also contact tech support. So let's look at where you can find some of this stuff in the API reference. In the 3X website, there's a mobile section under the guide. There's some different topics in here, such as meta tags that go in your application that affect mobile devices. So you may have been on a website before and you zoom in or you pinch zoom in to expand and make the text larger. You can keep people from doing that if you don't want them to scale your app in and out, which you should do that. But that being said, if you don't let them zoom in and out like that, then you should probably make sure that you have a view in the app that's appropriate for that device. And that's kind of some of the responsive stuff that we're going to talk about. So that there's information in here on that. There's also some references in here about Android and Apple design guidelines for how you should make your user interface look. You can use parts of the library, like Dojo has this module called has, and you can say has and then pass in a string to see if it has some type of functionality, and it'll return true or false, and then that will let you know if that is supported. Another library that does that same sort of thing is this one called Modernizer, and you can do the same type of thing to basically JavaScript loads, and then it checks the user agent, which is the string that says this is what version of the browser that I am, and then it will do a bunch of checks and then set up a bunch of Boolean variables if these things are true or false, and then it makes it really easy for you as a developer to just be able to load that and do that test. And then if the test fails, you can do some sort of fallback thing where you wouldn't provide that functionality to someone. I'm not real sure how useful the device orientation is, but you can do that. Like maybe you navigate or change some functionality, but we have information about the device orientation events. One of the ones that's really bigger, and Andy's going to go into much more detail about this, is geolocation, and that allows the browser to access the device's location, and you can then say, here's restaurants near you or features near you, that type of thing. We have a section on frameworks. Frameworks provide functionality for you as a developer, so you don't have to do a bunch of custom code yourself in order to present different user interfaces or like single or multiple page architectures. And so jQuery is a pretty popular one, and the frameworks like Bootstrap, which is leverages jQuery, is another one of those. And then we won't really talk much about this, but PhoneGap is, and Andy mentioned Cordova, they're basically the same technology that allows you to be able to bundle your web application inside of the browser control for a device and bundle that up as a native application and deploy that to an app store, and then somebody can download that on the phone. So that's kind of an overview of what's in the guide topics. One of the things that I wanted to also mention is under the references, we had a session here at User Conference on optimizing. I don't know if any of you were able to attend that or not, but using the Web Optimizer or using Bower for custom builds allows you to build a custom build of the ArcGIS API for JavaScript for your specific application. And the reason this is important for mobile apps is to decrease that load time and the number of requests that the app has to make to pull down the modules, the JavaScript modules that your app is using for load performance time, because that will affect the end user experience for how long it takes the app to load. So there's references in there about that, and there's also a guide topic about Bower. Under the sample code, there's a few various different samples. Some of them use jQuery Mobile, and I urge you to check those out. This is the repo where much of this information is. It's under my GitHub account, and then mobile web apps JS. There's also a resources MD file in here, and what that is just a bunch of different collection of, you know, sample topics and such that Andy and I have put together over the years of doing this presentation, and it covers all kinds of different stuff, the samples, productivity, CSS preprocessors, static site generators, how to check your code with JS Hint or Lint, debugging and testing, links to how to debug Safari and Chrome, we're going to cover that. Talking about optimizing for mobile, using icon fonts instead of like sprite sheets, things that you can do with like application cache. We won't talk much about that in here, but that's a way you can force information to store locally in the browser's memory so it doesn't have to retrieve it. And so there's just way more stuff in here than we can possibly cover in this short amount of time that we have. So I would urge you to take a look at that. So let's move forward and talk about some of the things that you need to know about for designing for mobile. Fortunately, the map already just works. You can double tap to zoom in. You can two-finger tap to zoom out. You can swipe to pan. You can pinch to zoom in and zoom out. All of that's just already built in. There's nothing that you have to enable. It just works. From a user interface perspective, some of the stuff that you can do is use HTML input types for pulling up like a date spinner or picker. Here's an example in an application of the geocoder or the search widget and the locate button down in the right-hand corner. There is a mobile pop-up window. The default view of it's not very pretty. The sample that you will see is a bunch of code that I added to it to make it look a lot nicer. So that the sample that I'm going to show you has all the code in it that you would need to know how you make it look and change differently. The one bad thing about the pop-up mobile is it's not really responsive. It doesn't work for desktop. It's okay for tablet, but you'd still probably want to have a different experience for tablet, but it does work really well on phones. So if you're only really targeting phones, the mobile pop-up does look nice. It's just because it's one single view and it takes up the whole screen. So if you're on a big desktop screen, it looks pretty funny with it taking up the whole viewport of that. The Basemap Gallery is another widget in 3X that allows you to be able to switch between different base maps. The base map toggle basically gives you the ability to toggle between two different base maps. So if you're only really concerned with maybe showing a streets and a satellite kind of thing, you could leverage that to toggle back and forth between the different base maps. It's also possible to build custom components. And this attribute editing mobile sample that is in the SDK has this functionality. Basically, it has a jQuery mobile slider or panel that pops out, and then you can click on one of the named list items, which is the name of the map style type, like topographic or streets, and then it'll switch out the base map. So I'll just kind of show you where some of this stuff is and give you a look at that. The sample that I was talking about that has all this functionality in it is this citizen request sample. So you can already kind of tell it looks kind of funny. This thing's in the middle. There's the slide out thing that pops out. It'll switch out the base map. But if you look at that on, say, like the simulator, it looks a little bit more natural, like, you know, what something would look like. One of the other things I wanted to show you was that the input forms. So, like, depending on what type of HTML input form you use, it'll just pull up the native slider or scroller for you. And this did nothing. There was no magic to this. It's just that the browser recognizes that it's on a mobile device, and the input type tag just knows to pull up the spinner on the phone. So that's a way that you can, if folks are filling out forms in your app, you can make it a lot easier for them to be able to interact with that. I think that's it. So let's talk about productivity and code management. So how many of you are just sort of old school Notepad, WordPad, or VI, or just a straight up text editor? Only a few of you? Wow, okay. How many of you use like a real full-fledged IDE that has, you know, a bunch of other bells and whistles in it? Okay, wow. And the other of you that did not raise your hand, you're not writing code? Or what else do you use? TextMate? Anybody else have anything else out there? Visual Studio Code?
Brackets.
Yeah. Everybody's asleep.
Yeah. Home run.
Okay, so you need to set up a local web server. You can't, the code won't run. The Dojo loader won't fetch the modules and load them into the app correctly unless you're accessing it through a web server. So some of the IDEs launch a local web server. The more versed you become at becoming a web developer, you'll probably run a local web server. And then it's pretty typical and standard for people to do things like check their code and format their code. And a lot of the IDEs already do that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about in this section. If you work by yourself, it's not that big of a deal, but if you work in a team, it's really kind of important to have some sort of standards. How do you, you know, where do you put the braces? You know, are things on an additional line, or are they at the end of the line? The reason why that is if like you check your code into source code control or like GitHub or something, if you don't have a consistent code formatting, you'll end up with people will just, if they end up have it like automatically format their code, they'll end up making additional commits where it looks like the code changed, but it was really just the formatting. And if you have different people with different standards, you'll constantly be recommitting the code formatted differently when you didn't really change the intellectual property in there. It was just changing the way it looked. So just a little FYI, if you work in a team environment, that's something really good to have. And a lot of these IDEs, like I said, just will format it automatically for you. Or how many of you raise a hand are using Node? A few of you. Anybody using a static site generator to build their content? No? Okay. Really, whenever you are building a larger site, static site generators can save you a lot of time. Basically, what it allows you to do is to separate out the different pieces of your website, like the header nav, sub nav, footer, the navigation tree maybe on the left-hand side, and it's, all of those pieces kind of get injected and built into the pages that become your website. So if you're not building a larger website that has many pages, maybe you don't have any use for that. One of the things that they do provide is kind of like the page reload and the dry principle, don't repeat yourself. And then with NPM, you can use NPM scripts, or you can use Gulp or Grunt. Basically, they're like JavaScript task automators. You can have files be watched, and as the file changes, it'll format it, or it'll run it through a checker to make sure that there's no syntax error. So the whole point of this section is for you to kind of learn how to work smarter, not harder, and because bugs, syntax errors can waste a lot of your development time. And the less of those that you have, you can spend that time working more on writing the application. Because as you complicate things, moving from building a desktop application, working with the browser there, to working with the browser on the devices, you've added another layer of complexity in here with these. And the more of these things that you can avoid, the more time it'll save you. And time is money for almost everyone. So JSHint, JSLint, those are code validation tools. We have some resources out there where you can see what kind of things that we do, but basically it looks for opening and closing curly braces, semicolons, checking to where normally JavaScript code would fail in the browser. So it can save you in that regard. Andy's going to talk a little bit about Bootstrap. In general, these CSS frameworks that provide responsive design have a couple components. They have a JavaScript library that usually handles the interaction between clicking a tab or expanding an expand box or a panel or something that requires user interaction. That will kick off an event that you can then listen to and do something else. Then they also have this large, generally, CSS framework that handles the grid for when you expand or collapse the window size. Features then will appear or disappear based upon what they call CSS media queries that essentially make things show up or hide as the viewport changes. So if you've never heard of CSS preprocessors, SAS is one, LESS is another, Stylus is another, and basically they just allow you to use functions and variables and what they call mixins, things that you can reuse, and then it spits out and can also compress your CSS. So I'll just show you something real quick here related to that in case you've never seen it and don't know what I'm talking about. This is SASMeister, and what you can do is put your SAS code. So SAS stands for Syntactically Awesome Style Sheets. And you can see here that we have like a pixel to M's. So M is a unit of measure of the pixel size, the font size, and then expressing that and what it would be with pixels. So this is a function where you can pass in, on line 7, 18 pixels and the pixel to m function, and then on the right-hand side, it says the button width is 1.125 m's. So this is just a little bitty thing with that. Functions, mixins, variables, you can use all of this stuff in your SAS or basically your CSS preprocessor code. And then when you run that code through the CSS preprocessor, it spits out the raw CSS. And you can combine and separate and modularize all of your CSS for your website and then run it through the CSS preprocessor and essentially get your one CSS file for your whole application. And it does add a layer of complexity to your application, but it does also have its benefits with regard to if you end up using Bootstrap and you really want to make modifications to the source, you'll want to be modifying the source SAS and not modifying the compiled CSS. So debugging and testing, you're working, you're building your application, you get it on your device and the thing doesn't work. What do you end up doing? The best scenario is that you have your own devices. You can buy them yourselves. That gets kind of expensive. You can buy used, like last generation or a year or 2 year old devices off of eBay or Amazon or things like that. The picture on the right is typically what someone that's constantly doing mobile development does. They have their desktop view. Generally, they use some kind of like a Node a script or something to run like what we call a live reload. Whenever you make a change in one in the code, all of the browsers will reload and refresh and reload that so you don't have to go to each one and click the refresh button. And you work very productive. You make changes to your code. All the devices reload. You see what it looks like immediately. You know if there's something broken. Not everyone can do that. The other option is like going to a device lab. Some areas have device labs. You could get together with a group of folks in your area and start a device lab. But basically, you can just go there and rent time and work your app on these different devices. So that's an option. These are some links for remote debugging. Link to the Safari, the Chrome. I talked about Live Reload. Another Node module that's pretty popular is Browser Sync. And for remote debugging in Safari, you have to actually enable that. Under the advanced settings of Safari, you have to check the pill that says enable the web inspector. And I have, I'll just show you this, but this is the backup in case my phones didn't work for some reason. But in Safari, like Andy's going to show Android, but you really need to have a Mac and have an iOS device in order to test and do this remote debugging of Safari on an iOS device, because there's no Safari on Windows anymore. But under the develop, it'll show the device, and then you can inspect the tab that way. And then you can like set breakpoints in the code, and whenever you hit it in the app, it'll actually pause on the device, and you can see it interactively on your desktop. And with the Chrome remote debugging, if you type Chrome:// inspect, that brings up a special page in Chrome, and you can see the devices there. Same thing, you can do the remote debugging, set a breakpoint in there, and it'll pause. So let me see if I can't show you this here real quick. How are we doing on time, Andy?
You got 1 minute.
So I have my phone plugged in through USB cable. That's what you need to do. And if you go and see here, it says my iPhone 5S. And these files that we're looking at here are actually loading on my phone. You can't see it, but whenever I click refresh up here, it's actually refreshing the thing on my phone. And you can also go down here in the console and interact with what's running in the browser, in the DOM, on the phone. And with Chrome, as I mentioned, you can, if you just go to Chrome Inspect, it'll show you what is actually running on the phone. And the nice thing about Chrome is that you can actually just type in here and say, hey, I want to open this on the phone, and it will launch the tab on the browser on the phone. Well, that's really handy. And the reason why you want something like Live Reload is because it's a pain in the butt selecting the address bar on here and typing in the URL. So you really want something that you run on your desktop that basically injects a JavaScript into the all of the browsers, and every time you make a change, it timestamps that and it tells them all to reload and push that out to the client. So there's the more you do this and the more you interact with it and the more of this development, you might not be real productive in the beginning, but once you do get to the point of getting to where you're just really kicking it, you'll be so much happier in your development, and you'll be spending a lot more time working on building the application than farting with the setup.
Hitting your head against the wall.
Or that, too. So I know that was a lot of information, but we're going to turn it over to Andy now, and he's going to open the fire hose.
You guys ready? All right. I see two thumbs up. It took. How many of you in here are using some sort of user interface library? Ooh, nice. So for those of you that aren't, some of the main reasons why we're using these libraries, and I'll go into more detail. Productivity. Do you want to build buttons and pop-ups and modal windows and things like that from scratch? Sometimes yes, usually not. Those are included in these frameworks. They come with HTML elements, themes, CSSs, boilerplates, JavaScript APIs. The bottom line is it makes your life go easier. You can build larger applications faster. You can do things within the user interface across multiple browsers without having to worry about a lot of the individual peculiarities that exist between Safari on an iPhone and Chrome on an Android device, especially on Android, right? Because there's many older versions. The majority of Android users out there are using older phones, right? Not the latest 6.x version of the Android operating system. So we have taken upon ourselves, we have a number of open source repos built on some of the responsive frameworks, and this is a two-page table that we've taken the liberty to build out samples and libraries that show how to use these frameworks with the ArcGIS API for JavaScript. We have a Bootstrap library, Bootstrap Map JS, and these are at github.com/esri. And then if you just search for Bootstrap or insert the name that's shown here in the left-hand column, this shows how to use our mapping library within the Bootstrap environment, and it supports the ArcGIS API for JavaScript version 3. If you are currently using Bootstrap and you want to look at using our ArcGIS API for JavaScript version 4, we're encouraging you to take a look at Calcite Maps. How many people in here have actually taken a look at Calcite Maps? So this is a great introduction to it. We don't have a whole lot of time to go into these, but I'm just going to take the liberty to show an example here. Take it out of presenter mode. So, Esri.com bootstrap map. I just wanted to show you a couple of quick examples of, there's just some samples in here that show how to build a responsive mapping application and let the ArcGIS API for JavaScript work correctly within this environment. So this is a responsive framework. And by moving, by shrinking the screen, I'm just demonstrating really quickly different breakpoints that would demonstrate different screen sizes. So if you're using a phone, a tablet, a desktop, this is a mobile-first style of framework. And it's a great way to make sure that your map is auto-centered. Did you notice as I decreased the screen size, the map is still staying centered. So if you were to rotate the screen from portrait to landscape, a lot of us do that sometimes when we're using field data collection apps, the map's going to stay centered. Everything's going to work okay within that particular framework. Pretty cool, right? We've done a lot of the work for you inside that template. We also just have a library for if you're using jQuery Mobile. If you're doing development for PhoneGap / Cordova environments, a lot of those that aren't using Angular are going to be using jQuery Mobile. We've built a library that helps the ArcGIS API for JavaScript map services work correctly in those environments. This is also a repo out on GitHub. That's for the JavaScript API version 3. If you're using JavaScript API version 4, this library and its content has been moved directly into the JavaScript API for making sure that the map auto-centers, making sure if you have multiple views within your application that the map is going to work okay when you come back to it or rotate the orientation of the phone. It's no longer needed in JavaScript API version 4. So that's very cool. We took all that functionality and moved it into the core library. How many people in here are using Angular? A few. If you are using Angular 1, the Angular Esri map, which is out on our GitHub site, this is a set of directives that shows you how to work with the ArcGIS API for JavaScript version 3 and version 4. We currently only support Angular 1.3 plus. We're working on Angular 2. So if you're doing Angular, definitely take a look at this repo. Calcite Maps, which I mentioned earlier, which is replacing Bootstrap Maps. Calcite Maps is essentially a responsive framework. It's using a brand new look and feel for building responsive applications. It's also we're using a similar or the same framework in some cases on the Esri.com, developer.arcgis.com websites. There's a styler application in here that you can test out using the Calcite themes. You see the banner, the pull downs, how everything is styled. You can go in here and play with this styler application and check out different themes for changing the look and feel of your application. This is continually evolving. Do all sorts of manipulation with this. Don't have time to go into the details, but you get the idea. You can go in there and play with it. Highly encourage you to start using it and take advantage of the work that we've already done. Did that actually show, or did I forget to? Oh, it did. Last but not least, PhoneGap Cordova, as Lloyd mentioned, we have a getting started repo for this out at github.com/Esri. Couldn't fit the whole name in there, so it just says the framework name is. If you just search for PhoneGap, you'll find it. Exactly, and Lloyd said there's guide topics for ArcGIS API version 3 and version 4 in the API documentation. getting started samples specifically for the 3.x API out on this repo that shows you the pattern for using these applications. We're working on version 4, and it's coming soon. So moving along, we're going to switch and talk about mobile pop-ups and just cover a little bit more information and summarize some of what Lloyd already covered. And JS API version 3.x, info window, if you're already using info window, it's going to work just fine on tablets. Don't want to be using it on smartphones. You can use it on tablets and desktop. Mobile pop-ups, Lloyd also showed you a demo of that. That's great for tablets and smartphones, not so good on desktop. So the reason why we're showing this to you is because in version 4, which is a completely responsive design, is the pop-ups work great across tablets, smartphones, and desktops. So just to go back a slide, version 3, you kind of have to pick and choose, as Lloyd was saying, what works on a phone, what doesn't. Version 4, yay! One API works great across multiple platforms, multiple devices. Pretty cool, right? So just to recap, info window, it's not responsive, it's not touch friendly, doesn't auto center on rotate. You can do it, but the users won't appreciate it. The mobile pop-up, readable, touch friendly, and rotate friendly, but not so great on desktop browsers, right? This sample is pulled directly out of the 3.x documentation. Version 4, yay! Responsive, touch friendly, rotate friendly, screen size friendly. Win, win, win. Huge benefit. Huge amount of work went into making this work well. In terms of making it responsive, not going to go into too much detail, but under pop-ups in the documentation, right up at the very top of the screen, there's things called dock options, breakpoints. I'm not going to go into any details. You can check these out. Where it's positioned, wanted to make sure that I pointed this out. All sorts of stuff that you can do to customize the pop-ups in the version 4 world. So what do I mean by this? I can do a quick demo. If I can grab. So notice as I decrease the screen, but I'm simulating decreasing the screen size by just moving this center divider left to right. You can see that there's some breakpoints there. The pop-up on a larger screen may be floating in an automated position. We can set it in all sorts of different places. We can hard dock it to the right. We can hard dock it to the bottom left. As soon as someone views that on a smaller screen, this is very cool. This is super convenient for you from a development perspective. It'll auto dock some point. Super mobile friendly. Double win, right? Yay. Life will be so much easier. Moving right along. Mobile performance. Get to talk to a lot of customers about mobile performance. A lot of us, I'm guilty, we're building these applications on super powerful machines, usually. Even the slowest desktop machine is going to be faster than your average smartphone. My Nexus 5 has about 14 gigabytes less than my laptop in terms of memory, has significantly less CPU power, and we all know, you've all experienced this, internet connections in the United States, how good are they? Not good. No, not good. Even in the center of town, you're going to have fluctuations. So if you have any takeaway from this presentation today, and without rehashing everything that Lloyd said, focus on small tweaks that are giving you big gains, and not just performance from a development perspective. We're talking performance of the application specifically. One of the things that's very common, especially when you're working within the browser, a common term that's floating around the internet these days is called jank or freezing or jerkiness. You've all experienced this. It's like when you go to scroll something and the screen freezes for just a second, or the application's doing so much work it just locks up, or in many cases the browser may just crash, or you get warning messages from the operating system. This is just not good, right? It's not a great user experience. So what we like to talk about is behind the scenes, we do a lot of heavy lifting in GIS, right? We're not doing a social media application. We're not doing light operations. We're moving a lot of data around. We're doing some significant work, heavy-duty algorithms. But the thing to keep in mind is as a general rule of thumb, if an operation takes more than 16 milliseconds, just say that again, more than 16 milliseconds, which isn't very long, the screen is going to freeze and it's going to lock up. That's not very long. So in comparison between the 3.x API and the 4.x API, even on the API side, we've done a tremendous amount of optimization to try and eliminate a lot of these inconveniences that you get when the user interface isn't working smoothly. And the biggest problem with this UI freezing or jerkiness, decreased usability. If it's freezing up constantly and your field workers are trying to do something, they're going to get frustrated. It's going to decrease their productivity. If you have a public-facing app, it's going to decrease the number of times that people are going to visit your website, because they're just going to be like, I can't use that thing, right? So how do we fix this? Can't do much about the internet. Sometimes we're downloading large files, shapefiles, CSV files, GeoJSON files. We're doing heavy processing on the main thread, or we're just thrashing the layout of the web browser. So we have some things that we can do. Again, small changes with big gains. We have spinners and progress bars. Bootstrap has a nice progress bar. There's examples of spinners all over the internet. So if you're doing some heavy processing and you know what's going on, you can throw up a spinner up there and tell the user, we're doing something big here, and cover up the user interface behind it, especially if you're doing a long-running activity. Also, when the application's loading, if you have to preload a lot of layers, another trick that we do is you can load a UI splash screen in the front and then lazy load the maps and layers in the background. That was pretty cool, right? Did you guys see that? So I'm just lazy loading this application in the background, and I gradually fade out that splash screen. Just the technique. Pretty cool. It's making it easier on the eyes. And as Lloyd was saying before, in the Chrome developer tools, there's also some very strong profiler tools for looking at CPU. Looking for things that are using a tremendous amount of CPU, small changes that have a big impact. And we'll look at some of these. The way we measure this stuff is we use console.time. I think this works in Chrome and Firefox, sometimes in Safari. It's console.time, the name of the string, console.timeend, same name of the string, and it will print out a message in your console that said how long it took to run the code between those two things. Pretty cool, very convenient, right? It's measuring time in 1/1000th of a millisecond. So what's happening, and the reason why we focus on this is because from the end user perspective, it's how long it took to download the GeoJSON, how long it took to do something with this GeoJSON as an example, and then how long it took for it to render. And it's from the very beginning of when you start to download data until the end when it's actually projected on the user's screen that we want to look at. So let's just take a look at an example. I have an application here that is going to go out and grab a USGS GeoJSON file of earthquakes. And we're just going to run through three quick examples. We're going to have the first one's going to be on the main thread. The second one is going to be using a web worker, just one. And the third time we run this, we're going to be using two web workers just to demonstrate how we can benefit from performance on the main thread. Of course, we lose the internet. Convenient thing is, no internet. I really lose the internet? Oh. I think I just got my URLs wrong. Okay, so I'm going to rerun this. And down here in this lower left-hand corner, if the internet cooperates. Okay, so 7,000 milliseconds for it to go out and grab this USGS earthquake file, to parse it on the main thread, and to display it. So now what we're going to do is we're just going to throw one web worker at it. It says none. So now we're just going to throw it on one web worker. That was significantly faster. So with one web worker, we're down from 7 seconds to 840 milliseconds. That's a significant boost. And then last but not least, let's split this parsing task across two web workers. So now we're down to 455 milliseconds from about 7.5 seconds. So what do you guys think is going to happen when I throw this one worker application over onto my Android phone? Any bets on how long this is going to take? I'm feeling brave. I got 30 seconds. So we're going to do what Lloyd was talking about. We're going to say Chrome inspect. That one didn't pick it up. We're going to pick it up here. I ran it in the background so you guys didn't have to wait. No web workers on my Android Nexus 5, 20,000 milliseconds. Okay, so let's go ahead and close this. Just lost my cursor. So let's take a look at, I'm just going to skip one worker and just go to two workers. We went down from 20 seconds to 2.5 seconds. So from running on the main thread to moving that application to two workers off the main thread and web workers, we went from 20 seconds to 2.5 seconds. Which one is your end users going to prefer? Pretty cool, right? Very important. So use web workers where you can. Minimize, concatenate, optimize your data, whatever you can to decrease the amount of data that's coming across the wire. Turn gzip compression on your server. How many of you know that gzip's turned on? Huge performance benefit. You can just search for this on the internet. Just search for turn on gzip IIS. Turn on gzip, Apache, whatever web server you're running. Also consider using feature layer mode on demand. Mode on demand will just capture data in a query for what's in the visible extent rather than downloading everything. Consider limiting extents that users can view. Consider zooming down instead of zooming out where there may be more features. Use layer dependencies. generalized features. Do whatever you can to make it easy for the end user. So what I'm going to do here is I'm querying a very large object. And we're downloading, we're running a query. Oops. We're running a query and it, I don't know if you can see it here. I'm trying to zoom in without blowing up my screen. It took 3.15 seconds over our fast internet here. And what I'm going to do is just throttle this connection down to about mobile speeds. And this is 197K zipped. And we're going to query this feature again. Running, running, waiting. 4.83 seconds. So what I'm trying to demonstrate here is by decreasing the size, thinking about mobile from a limited internet perspective, keeping these things in your mind when you're doing mobile development, you can make a significant difference from a user interface perspective.
Also, too, like Andy mentioned with the generalization, if your application isn't doing editing and you're not doing anything with the geometry on the client that requires data accuracy, like calculating an area or anything like that, with the feature layer, it's set up to auto-generalize by default, and you can use the max allowable offset, and that'll actually tell the server to generalize the data on the server before it sends it to the client. And that, with also the gzip compression, will significantly decrease the payload that's sent over the wire from the service to the feature layer on the client.
That's a really good point. Thank you. Yeah, max allowable offset. It's typically included with ArcGIS Online requests, but if you're hosting your own portal or ArcGIS server, definitely consider that. So as we start to head home on this presentation, I wanted to switch gears to the last two sections and talk real quick about GPS and give you some things to think about as you're winding your way home after the conference. And I did a little experiment at the Colorado office. I just took my smartphone. I was going to use the smartphone. In fact, I was actually using the Runtime SDK. The next screenshot I'm going to show you is from the Runtime SDK. But it's using the same data that the HTML geolocation API uses. The concept was that I was going to walk from the back of the building to the front of the building, and in theory, I'd get a straight line of points, right? How many people think it's going to be a straight line? Not a single hand. All right, so on the left was using a high accuracy GPS Bluetooth to the phone. What do you think is on the right? That is using the native phone GPS. So the blue dots represent where the cellular network thinks I am, and the red dots is where the GPS thinks I am. Not simulated, not faked, not good. Here's standing in one place for 5 minutes. Which one of those is your location? Take your pick. At best, under absolutely perfect conditions, 3 to 10 meters. Perfect conditions is no sky cover, no clouds, no trees, no buildings, no cars. Flat ground for miles. And even then, it might not be 3 to 10 meters. This is GPS accuracy we're talking about here. If you want to force the phone to use GPS, put it in airplane mode. Turn the Wi-Fi off. I get asked about this a lot. Put it in airplane mode. Turn off the Wi-Fi. Don't use snapshot geolocation. Absolutely not reliable. The best way to get a single location, especially if you're using field data collection with the geolocation API, is or you're doing tracking, is to use navigator.geolocation.watchposition. And this is all in the documentation on the internet for HTML geolocation. As we saw, locations bounce all over the place, just not good. What's happening in the HTML geolocation is you're getting a combination of the first location that comes in may be a GPS, the second location that comes in may be a network location. As you saw, those were spread out all over the place. And if you try and center your map using the locations as they come in, your map bounces all over the place. So we have two solutions for this. The first one is buffering. The second one would be if you're a Cordova PhoneGap user, you can use a hybrid plugin. Buffering, which means we're capturing a whole bunch of points and we're just going to average them and then calculate the centroid. And you're like, oh my goodness, that's a lot of math. Who's going to do that? Ta-da, we did it for you. And you can also use the Geometry Engine client side, exactly. Oops. So what does that look like? We're running out of time, so I'm working on wrapping this up. This one. So this application right here, this is what it looks like. I've been leaving this running. And go ahead and turn it off and zoom out. So you could, it's got a red circle, that's usually not good. It's creating an array of points as it's running. And the most important thing about this is it'll give you an average center location. You can tell, what do we got here? 48 meters. So if you wanted to do some precise location, that's just not good. That's our averaged center. This has the algorithm built in. Feel free to go out and check this thing out. It's been running for the last 50 minutes, and the best center point I can get, the best accuracy, even averaged, is about 50 meters. HTML5 geolocation tool is out on the GitHub site. We've done all the math for you. You can just check that out. Give it a spin. Cordova uses the exact same geolocation API as really the takeaway from this. Another advantage of Cordova is it can do geolocation in the background. So if you've minimized the application, there's some plugins that allow you to do geolocation in the background, and that does work with our JavaScript API. We've built a plugin, Cordova plugin advanced, that lets you separate those network locations from GPS. So all that bouncing around that's happening, this plugin will help you minimize that. It also has a centering algorithm in it, just like the HTML5 geolocation tool that I just showed you. Calculates the centroid, significantly reduces the bouncing that you're going to get. And last but not least, if you're using an external GPS, as you can see, significantly greater accuracy, specifically if you're using something like the Trimble R1, which is a sub-meter external Bluetooth-based GPS. It overrides the geolocation API. You don't have to use anything special except installing Trimble software. And it works on iOS and Android. They're expensive, but if you need sub-meter, that is definitely the way to go. So just keep that in mind the next time you see your locations all over the place. If you really want to narrow it down and do highly accurate field data collection using JavaScript, this is really the way to go. So last but not least, we have some quick starts for Cordova. As I mentioned before, it's Quick Start Map PhoneGap. It's out on our GitHub site. The plugin that I showed you for Cordova is also out on github.com/Esri. And with that, we'll start wrapping it up. So mobile is not the desktop. We're building on powerful machines, not necessarily going to reflect what's happening in the real world. We have a dedicated internet connection, not a real-time internet. Remote debugging, very powerful way to check what's going on the device. No need to guess. You can even take a laptop with you into the field, hook your device up to it, debug it, and see what's going on. Special performance considerations. These phones are really working hard to do the best that they can, but there's many things that you saw that we can do to make performance better, not only from the user interface perspective, but from a GPS perspective, and really making that user experience significantly better. Got anything to add to that?
I don't think so. I mean, the one thing that you definitely can tell is that if your app's not performing very well, the temperature of the phone will let you know.
A lot of resources that'll be available in this presentation. When the presentations become available after the conference, yeah, the phones do get hot, especially if you're running the GPS. Or really hot if it's in your pocket and you forget to turn the GPS off. Please fill out our survey. There's not much information on this slide. It just says get the Esri Events app from Google Play or App Store. Give us good feedback. End of the conference. Hopefully we've filled you full of all sorts of mobile goodness. And with that, I guess we'll start taking questions. Questions? Yes. A web worker, the question is, what is a web worker? A web worker is part of the JavaScript API specification.
Not ours. The general one.
What's Lloyd saying? Yeah, this is the general W3C JavaScript API specification. It has nothing to do with Esri. It's built into the browsers. And it lets you transfer work off the main thread, because everything that you run in JavaScript is running on one thread. What this lets you do is spin off tasks onto a separate thread to allow the user interface to continue to work smoothly or more smoothly. And then when that task is done, bring the information back to the user interface. And if you want, to come up here afterwards, we can show you some more information. But it is essentially a way to spin off other threads to do additional work. Other questions? Yes?
Can you guys bring kinetic panning to 4.0?
The question was, can we bring kinetic panning to 4.0? It's not the first time that's been asked. Lloyd, do you want to take that one?
I have a business card. I can give you my business card if you want. Or you can submit feedback through the, where I said respond. Down in the bottom right-hand corner of like all the pages of the 4X SDK has a submit feedback. You could email that way. It'll get to me that way. I know there's been discussion about it before, and I can't remember what it was, but I think it was at the Dev Summit in Europe. Somebody had asked about it too. So, I mean, it's on the radar. I just don't remember what the conversation was about it.
Last question before we wrap this up and you guys get ready for the party. Well, thanks everybody for attending. Hope you had a great week, good conference. And if you have other questions, we'll be up here for a few more minutes. Thank you for attending.